It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll find out why a state business group says it's time to pick a new slogan for Wisconsin license plates.
First, Marathon County could become the latest Wisconsin county to join a lawsuit targeting pharmaceutical companies for their role in the opioid crisis. Several states around the country, including Ohio and Pennsylvania, have started filing similar suits.
But our next guest says that the state and local governments could face an uphill legal battle when they take on drug companies.
Carl Tobias joins us now. He's the Williams Chair in Law for the University of Richmond School of Law. Carl, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Well, what are your thoughts on the prospects for these lawsuits, local governments suing big drug manufacturers for popularizing, overselling, they're saying, these opioid medications?
Well, I think there's no question that there's a crisis around the country, and it's worse in certain parts of the country than others, and that it's extremely costly in terms of human lives, in terms of children, in terms of society. And so that's not in question. The questions are many because I don't think anyone has seen a case through all the way through the system, and most of them have just started. And it's a sort of cutting-edge area of the law, and the legal theories are not entirely clear. And so that's what makes it difficult to know whether they'll be able to impose civil liability, which I think they're trying to do, and then what the damages might be if a judge or jury were convinced that the counties and cities and states should be awarded damages.
Are there comparable cases in the past with local or state governments banding together to sue big industries like this?
Yes, there have been a number of different efforts. Guns are one area, but also the tobacco litigation, I think, is looked at as the most important and perhaps relevant precedent from really the 80s and 90s, which ultimately resulted in a global settlement that's, you know, still ongoing.
What are the key differences between that tobacco case and this opioid case?
Well, the industry is different. Here it's, I think, mostly the pharmaceutical industry. And the questions of marketing are somewhat similar, but in this situation, you're talking about circumstances typically where there's a doctor who prescribes and knows the patient and perhaps prescribes the opioids for a particular patient for particular circumstances. And so that makes it somewhat different, though there are some similarities. For example, I think it's pretty clear that cigarettes and tobacco were over-promoted by the industry, and I think that's the same claim that's being made here, that pharmaceutical companies over-promoted use of opioids and also understated the risk. And I think that's somewhat similar to cigarettes and tobacco products. So there are some similarities, but there are also maybe some differences.
One difference seems to be these are medications regulated by the FDA. They set guidelines on how these drugs could be sold, prescribed, distributed. Does that take some of the responsibility away in a legal sense from these companies?
Perhaps, but not necessarily. Of course, today tobacco is regulated by the FDA, but of course that was done by Congress. But I think that's a well-taken point, that it's possible that the companies will say, well, FDA approved, you know, this product, and that means it's okay. But at best, that's kind of a minimum floor. And that's apart from the allegation about over-promoting or perhaps fraud. The addictive qualities of opioids and all of those problems that have arisen, I think, you know, when you understate those, that is serious and could lead to liability and has in other areas.
We're talking to Carl Tobias, law professor at the University of Richmond, looking at local government and state government lawsuits targeting drug manufacturers over their role in the opioid crisis. A couple of Wisconsin counties are considering joining that. Carl, how important is it to prove, I guess, bad intent on the part of the industry? Does there have to be a smoking gun type of document that says, hey, these drug companies knew these medications were more addictive than they were telling the public?
Well, that would be valuable if it were the case, and there may be such documents. And part of what's going on is to see what I think can be found in discovery once that starts in these pieces of litigation around the country. And that would make a much stronger case. But I think that there'll be some information that's pretty readily available in terms of what kind of advertising was done, how did the detail people who, you know, often go and visit doctors, encourage doctors to move forward with prescriptions of opioids. And so there probably are many medical professionals who could testify as to the over promotion, and you could also look at, you know, how the use has ballooned in many places. So it may not be that difficult to show.
As I understand it, a lot of the local governments getting into this kind of lawsuit, it's not their, you know, their counsel, their legal counsel for the city or the county. This is a private law firm or group of lawyers coming around to local government saying, hey, sign on to our lawsuit with other municipalities and counties. Does that matter once it hits the courts, the different method?
I don't think so. We have a fairly long tradition in this country of lawyers outside government helping governments to bring litigation. It very frequently happens with the attorneys general's offices, even though they have a fairly large staff in most states. You may need that very specialized expertise in a particular area, and my guess is that the firms that are trying to do this work do build that expertise pretty quickly, and it's hard to staff up within, say, an attorney general's office or a county, which may have several, you know, lawyers, or smaller cities, just may not have either the resources or the expertise that someone who works on this kind of issue all the time might bring to bear.
I wanted to ask about standing, which is whether or not the person or entity filing the lawsuit has the legitimate standing to be bringing it to court. It looks like these local governments are saying this opioid epidemic, it's driving up our costs in our city or county or state. We're having to do more law enforcement, administering anti-overdose drugs, that kind of thing. Is that enough in a court setting to get standing?
Well, I think it can be, but you're correct. It's a technical hurdle that you have to overcome in this context. And I expect the companies, defendants, will vigorously dispute that there is standing. But typically, you have to show that you have an interest and that interest has been harmed. What you were talking about a minute ago, I think, would be sufficient, though it will be contested.
Looking at responsibility for the opioid epidemic, we've been talking about this a lot, and there are a lot of different pieces to this puzzle. You mentioned the doctors who prescribe. There's this big report on the distributors from 60 Minutes and Washington Post. We talked about that yesterday. There's the manufacturers themselves. There's government regulators. And then, of course, there's the illegal side of heroin and other opioids. Is it going to be easy for cities and counties to say, hey, these companies, these manufacturers in particular, bear a significant amount of that responsibility?
Well, that's tricky. I mean, how you divide up that responsibility, and you're correct, there are many individuals and entities that probably play some role there. I think one of the most difficult parts is there typically is a prescribing physician with an individual patient or patients. And traditionally, in a number of states, the law requires basically that the warnings and information and promotion go to the doctor, not directly to the patient. and we something called the learned intermediary rule, and that may come into play, though it's not entirely clear that that would govern here. But typically that has helped the companies defend themselves in that situation, putting more responsibility on the doctor.
And Carl, as we wrap up, as you mentioned earlier, this is in its earliest stages. How long would something like this take to move through the courts?
Well, it just depends on how complicated it turns out to be. Maybe if one county or a small number of counties is suing in Wisconsin, maybe it wouldn't be so onerous in terms of time. But I think you would have to, you know, have some discovery and pretrial litigation. So it could take a year to two and maybe as much as three.
Carl, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Carl Tobias, professor at the University of Richmond School of Law. He joined us to talk about the growing number of local governments and states that are suing pharmaceutical manufacturers over their role in the nationwide opioid crisis.
Coming up, we'll hear why there's some buzz around the idea of getting rid of the slogan America's Dairyland on Wisconsin license plates. And we want to hear what you think. You can call up with your ideas for a new slogan at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Stay with us here on Central Time.
Kurt Bauer, Executive Director of Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, says, hey, it's time to change up Wisconsin's license plates.
Now, in specific, he'd like to maybe get rid of that slogan, America's Dairyland. Bauer says the slogan doesn't capture the full spectrum of what Wisconsin is today and maybe could limit outside perceptions of our state.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think it's time to take America's Dairyland off of our license plates? And if so, what would you like to replace it with? Is the slogan America's Dairyland too limited? And again, give us your new contenders. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org.
Mark Sommerhauser joins us now. He's a political reporter at the Wisconsin State Journal, where he recently wrote about this idea. Mark, welcome back.
It's great to be with you.
Well, Mark, this idea has been kicking around for a while, but what does Kurt Bauer have to say about getting rid of this slogan today?
Yeah, well, you know, Kurt Bauer is, you know, I would say is sort of made a little bit of a splash with this idea when he floated it yesterday at the at an event, a luncheon event that was sponsored by Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce. He's actually been talking about this for more than a year, and he had originally written a column in the Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce magazine back in April 2016, floating this idea, that perhaps as part of what he described as an image makeover that Wisconsin perhaps is due for, that part of that could include thinking about a new slogan on the state license plate. And, you know, he, in the column that he wrote last year, kind of laid out the notion, making the case, if you will, for this image makeover, that while the you know, state's ties to the dairy industry are an important part of the state's heritage and continue to be an important part of its economy, that I think, as you said in the intro, you know, his argument is that perhaps it can be a little bit limiting in terms of describing the diversity, both the economic and cultural diversity that exists in the state, you know, on a license plate, which is something that is going to be viewed by people living outside the state.
This slogan has been on there for a long time, at least as long as I can remember. Do you know any of the history behind it, Mark?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's been on the state license plate since 1940, so almost 80 years now that it's been on the state license plate. It's actually written in state law requiring that to be sort of the mantra, if you will, on the state license plate. And, you know, it's something that really has been on there ever since. There was, we just did a little bit of research when this issue came up yesterday and found some articles published in 1985 and 1986. There was somewhat of a debate at that time, actually, about whether to change the slogan. The governor at that time, Tony Earle, kind of kicked off a contest, actually, a statewide contest, where folks submitted ideas for different designs to for a new license plate, but they ultimately, when the contest was over and people had voted in it, you know, they ended up picking a license plate design that kept that America's Dairyland slogan.
And Foxconn could be an opening for changing things up with the license plate. What has Kurt Bauer had to say about that tie-in?
Yes, correct. I mean, he's sort of saying that Foxconn, because of the international attention that the Foxconn project has received, and by the way, for your listeners, that I would guess most of them are familiar with that by now, but it's a proposal that is going forward to build a liquid crystal display screen manufacturing facility in Racine County in the southeast part of the state. And, you know, the notion is that with this proposal, you know, it's created such an international splash that it offers Wisconsin a chance to sort of rebrand itself and help people outside the state sort of re-envision how they see Wisconsin. And so that's kind of his pitch, is that, you know, having a project of this stature offers that opportunity to make people think about Wisconsin perhaps more in the context of advanced manufacturing, electronics, technology, these types of things that obviously are emerging industries in the 21st century, you know, relative to agriculture.
We're talking to Mark Sommerhauser right now from the Wisconsin State Journal, talking about a new idea. Maybe get rid of America's Dairyland from Wisconsin's license plates to make room for new imaging that encompasses maybe more of what the state has to offer today. Not without controversy, but we're talking about that right now at 800-642-1234. We want to know what you think. Do you support that move, putting a new slogan on there, or do you like that heritage? Call us at 800-642-1234. And we'll take our first caller now. We've got Tom joining us first in Rhinelander. Tom, hi.
Hi.
What do you think?
I think that we should keep it on there, but I'm kind of a traditionalist. I also think we should go back to the yellow license plate that we had for so many years that looked like a nice big pound of fresh butter. The white plate that we have now with the tiny little part on the top, it just isn't visible from the road and it looks too generic. So I'll take responses off the air.
All right. Thanks, Tom. Well, Tom wants to go vintage with that, Mark, and go back to the yellow. I did kind of like the yellow. What do you think?
Yeah, the yellow would definitely be an eye-catching way to go. The ones that we have now that are kind of white with the red and black lettering are, you know, maybe a little more Spartan and a little less eye-catching.
We have a comment here from Andy in Madison who says he's suggesting home of the Packer Backers. I had to think a minute. Packer Backers. That's one from him. Cindy Rose says, yes, do away with America's Dairyland. Love Forward or Land of the Cheeseheads. Yeah, I like the Cheeseheads working its way in there. And let's take another call here. We've got Jay with us in Appleton. Jay, hello.
Hi. I just have a couple things to think about on this. Being a history lover, of course, and born and bred in Wisconsin, I would like it to stay America's Dairyland for a couple reasons. I'm really opposed to naming it after an industry or after a sports team. Milwaukee, for example, has always been known for a couple hundred years as manufacturing an industry. We've never had an identity crisis over that before. We're an immigrant state. We are the Dairyland. They may have been bankrupted out of existence almost, but are absolutely coming back with our small farms. Farmers, it's our history. And I don't think our state's had an identity crisis anywhere else. We're not the Silicon Valley. Do we want to be? I think let's stick true to our roots and stop being ashamed of our roots.
All right. Thank you, Jay. And that brings up a question, Mark. What has the dairy industry had to say about this idea?
Well, just as your caller was speaking, I was thinking, goodness, this sounds an awful lot like what the dairy industry has to say about this. And yeah, they you know, certainly are saying that they are not in favor of changing this slogan. A statement that we got from the Wisconsin Dairy Business Association today, again, was very similar in that, the dairy industry is something that has contributed to the culture and the economy of our state for so long that, in their words, it would be disheartening to change this slogan. And that, moreover, that this is a part of the state's heritage and history, and that that's something that Wisconsin should, should be proud of and should really be touting rather than turning away from.
It's an interesting question, Mark. Let me ask you, this isn't something you reported on, but when you travel outside of Wisconsin, what is the one thing that people know about Wisconsin?
I would have to say, if you say Wisconsin, probably the first thing that people associate is the Green Bay Packers or cheese.
Packers or cheese, yeah.
Yeah, or beer, maybe. Beer is another you know, with the state's brewing heritage. I think that's another thing that people really associate with Woodstown.
I can't see that one on a license plate, but I can see more of a reference to cheese in there. Yeah, so interesting point about the Silicon Valley and keeping our heritage going strong here on our license plates. Let's take another call from Tim in La Crosse. Tim, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Not bad. How about you?
Pretty good. I think the license plate should say Wisconsin, the formerly progressive state.
I'm going political with that one there, Tim. I have a feeling that will not pass muster, especially if it has to go through the legislature. Tim, thank you for that. Any other ideas out there that are being seriously kicked around, Mark, if people are taking this idea?
You know, that's a good question. I mean, part of what we wanted to get a handle on yesterday was how seriously this is really being discussed. Kurt Bauer mentioned it at this luncheon event, really in sort of an offhanded or sort of passing way. We ended up checking back with the organization. They filled us in a little bit on the background of how he's been sort of talking about this off and on over the course of the last year or so. But WMC, Wisconsin Manufacturing and Commerce, said that they have no plans to formally lobby lawmakers to make this change. They said it's just something that they're putting out there to start a conversation. We also checked in with Governor Scott Walker's office. You know, they told us that they have not been contacted in any sort of a formal way, you know, urging them to think about changing this. So if somebody is serious about it, you know, as I mentioned, it would take a change to state law. So it would need to go through the legislature and through the governor's desk to make that happen. And right now there's no indication that any sort of official efforts are underway, but that's certainly something we'll be continuing to watch.
Let's take another quick call here. We have Judy joining us next in Appleton. Hi, Judy.
Hi there. I think kids got to be left the same. America's Dairyland, that's what we've been for all these years. Let's keep it that way. And we could change the license. I like the idea of changing it to back to yellow.
Yeah, yellow.
That's a good idea, but make it so it looks like cheese.
Oh, brilliant. I love that, Judy. What a good idea. Yeah, we could make it look like cheese. I guess it would have to be Swiss cheese. Otherwise, I don't know where you go with that. But Judy, thanks. So another vote there, Mark, for keeping it the same. If you had to guess, what do you think is going to happen?
Boy, you know, if what happened in 1985 and 86 is any indication, the America's Dairyland mantra just seems like one that is going to be difficult to shed. You know, again, there was this discussion 30 years ago, and we ended up kind of right where we started with that same slogan. So if that's any indication, that one might be sticking with us for a while.
Mark, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Mark Sommerhauser with the Wisconsin State Journal looking at the idea of removing the slogan America's Dairyland from Wisconsin license plates.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Right now, we're taking another look at the aftermath of Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico. In just a bit, we'll speak with a Wisconsin doctor who experienced the storm firsthand with his family.
Puerto Rico is still recovering following the devastation left in the wake of Hurricane Maria. When the storm hit the U.S. territory at the end of September, it left the island completely without power and communication was largely cut off. Recovery efforts have been slow, especially compared with those in Florida and Texas.
Alan Gomez joins us now. He's a Miami-based reporter at USA Today. He's been covering the aftermath of Hurricane Maria. Alan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
How much of Puerto Rico is still without power today?
As of right now, there are still 82% of people on the island without power, and about 45% without access to clean water.
Now, we use a figure like 82% without power, but can you tell us what that actually means as far as the day-to-day of people's lives and their well-being?
Well, I mean, it's one of these things where any of us, and unfortunately we're seeing so many of these catastrophes going on around the country, but it's if you lose power for a few days, you know, you lose all the food in your fridge and that sort of thing. But as 1 week turns into two, turns into three, you know, all of a sudden your day-to-day changes completely. So, you know, these folks, they've unfortunately gotten used to just kind of sleeping outside, finding makeshift places to just get through the night. And it really affects their ability to work. It affects their ability to study if they're in school. It affects their ability to drive their cars because it's so hard even to get to some of these gas stations that are opening up, and especially on the water side of it. I mean, there's still people who spend their day in line waiting to get water at some of these creeks that people are getting water from, waiting in line to get water at some distribution centers that have been opening up little by little on the island. So it's sort of surviving and just getting through the day becomes a full day's enterprise. It's just incredibly difficult.
And I've been seeing reports about people drinking water that may not be safe, that they've collected without purification. What are the health risks there?
I mean, they're already getting all sorts of reports about bacteria infections that people are getting from the water. I mean, it's when you don't have the option and you see a creek, you're going to get water from it, and you're going to get as much of it as you can, and you don't have the ability and you don't have the technology available to you in that moment to test it to see, you know, how good it is, and then you don't have electricity, so in many cases it's hard to boil the water. A lot of people are starting we're starting to get more and more reports of this, but even getting the reports is difficult because a lot of the hospitals, a lot of them have power now, but it's hard. It's still very difficult to communicate with them. About 40% of the island still doesn't have cell service. So communication makes it hard, which makes it hard to identify how many people are getting sick, which then makes it harder to figure out where the response is needed and where we need to get more of these assets to.
Now, President Trump has said a few times since Maria made landfall in Puerto Rico that FEMA wouldn't be able to stay in the territory forever. It's hard to say whether he has some sort of timeline in mind, but what sort of message does that send?
I can tell you, if you're in Puerto Rico right now, it sends a very demoralizing one. When the president was there, he met with a few folks who were supportive of what he was talking about. But I can tell you that my colleagues who have been on the island and friends and other reporters I know who've been down there, they tell a very different story. If you were in San Juan and you're in a very protected area of the country, which is pretty much what President Trump saw on his short trip there, things aren't that bad. Water's getting back. You're getting some power back. But throughout the south end of the island, the west end of the island, these parts that are more rural and harder to get to, they are just absolutely beside themselves and pleading with the U.S. to get in there. We saw a very different message that he delivered when he went to Texas after Hurricane Harvey, a very different message when he went to Florida after Hurricane Irma tore through there. In both those cases, he was tweeting about the people in those states nonstop. He visited both of those states within 4 days of their hurricanes making landfall. He didn't get to Puerto Rico until 13 days after, and when he got there, he talked about what Puerto Ricans were doing to the federal budget. He said that they didn't experience a, quote, real catastrophe as like New Orleans did after Hurricane Katrina. And then he's just been following up with that, with saying, hey, we can't be in there forever. Meanwhile, there's about 50 FEMA disaster recovery centers open in Texas right now. There's another 18 open in Florida as people continue recovering from those storms. Yet with Puerto Rico, he talks about pulling out of there because they can't stay there forever.
Talking to Alan Gomez right now from USA Today. He's giving us an update on the latest from the recovery effort in Puerto Rico. And we've been talking about President Trump's ongoing commentary about the hurricane in Puerto Rico, his narrative that it has been a good response from the United States, that the job there has been robust. How is it being received, the job the U.S. has done in Puerto Rico? Are people on board with what the president has said, or what are you hearing?
I mean, the response has been robust. There has been a lot of assets that have gone down there. The FEMA administrator has gone down several times. The acting secretary of the Department of Homeland Security has gone down there. FEMA can, cite off the number of water pallets and food pallets that they've sent down there. But there's been a very big disconnect in all of that stuff getting to the people. We've heard President Trump talk about, well, the roads are messed up and they got to figure out their roads and otherwise they're not going to be able to distribute everything. But I can tell you, I've talked to many Puerto Ricans who ask, well, don't we have a lot of helicopters in the United States? Can't they, ferry some of this stuff down to the southern parts of the island to get it to some of these harder hit areas? Another sort of very visible example is there's this Navy ship called the USS Comfort that is this massive, massive medical ship that goes from disaster to disaster around the world to assist. This ship has 250 beds to treat people. At last check yesterday, according to CNN, there's only 33 patients on board because they haven't been able to figure out how to get people from the hospitals onto the ship. So it's the kind of situation where there's a lot of stuff going down there and a lot of equipment going down there, but they just haven't been able to get it out to a lot of these communities where people are still sitting there saying, yeah, every once in a while we'll see a water drop, but then we don't see anybody for a week or two. So there's been a very big breakdown in terms of coordinating this and figuring out how to get all these supplies to the people that need it the most.
And Alan, as we start to wrap up, when you look at what's left to do on the ground, what is at the top of the list?
Well, the top of the list is power and electricity and getting that up and running. It's again, it's I can't drive that number home enough. 82% of people still without power on the entire island this many weeks after the storm. That once you get that settled, then all of a sudden people are in air conditioning, so they're in a little bit safer situation, and their health care isn't that much of a risk. They can travel a little bit more freely, and that's the main thing. But going back to the president, all he's talked about is that, hey, the electricity infrastructure was damaged before the hurricane, so they got to figure something out. We haven't really seen a big push to fix that. We've even heard from Tesla, who's offered to go down there and try to help restructure the power grid, but that's a years-long process. That's not a couple of weeks process. So that's I think, the main thing that people are looking for now.
Alan, thanks a lot for talking today.
Absolutely. Thank you.
That is Alan Gomez, a Miami-based reporter at USA Today, and he joined us to give us an update on the latest in the recovery efforts after Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico.
Coming up, we'll talk to a La Crosse-based doctor who was visiting his family in Puerto Rico when Hurricane Maria hit. We'll get his firsthand account in just a moment. That's coming up on Central Time.
Puerto Rico is still continuing to recover from the aftermath of Hurricane Maria. Much of the island is still without power, and the death toll has been climbing.
For a Wisconsin doctor and his wife visiting their family on the island, they witnessed the devastation firsthand.
Dr. Julio Bird joins us now. He's a cardiologist at the Gunderson Health System Heart Institute in La Crosse, and he was in Puerto Rico when Maria hit. Dr. Bird, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
How did you and your wife wind up in Puerto Rico during the actual brunt of the hurricane, Hurricane Maria?
Both of us have a lot of family still living on the island. And even though we've been gone for nearly 40 years now, we stay very much in touch, trying to make a couple of trips every year. This actually started out as a well-planned semi-vacation trip. We made arrangements for the trip sometime in February, and we were going to just enjoy the company of family and the nice tropical weather as the weather got colder in La Crosse. But we then found out that Hurricane Irma had gone through and had done a fair amount of damage. Even though it didn't have highly destructive winds, it had knocked down lots of trees, etc. So we decided that we'd make it a working vacation. We had already our plane tickets and everything. And we went there, and we were going to initiate some of that work when we found out that there was this other tropical storm they were calling Maria that was threatening to become a hurricane. And, hope springs eternal, so we thought, well, it'll probably develop into something, but it'll go north, as they want to do most of the time. But found out that, no, that indeed it looked like all the models would indicate that there was going to be a strike. So that's 2 days prior to arrival, so there's very little time to make any changes in schedule, and certainly no time to hightail it out of town for various reasons.
And you had a lot of family there that you wanted to be
exactly.
near.
Exactly. Yeah, we were there with family, so it's not like you say, well, sorry, we're heading off. You guys do your very best. That's kind of not in either one of our wiring. So we decided, well, we could help get through the storm and all those things. And so we stayed. And not that even if we had wanted to leave, it would have been impossible to leave. So we stayed and then had to endure the strike of Maria.
And we're talking about winds that were 120, 150 miles per hour. You were in a concrete house. What was the experience like being inside, hunkering down while this hurricane hit?
Well, to me, it looked like out of a scene out of a submarine movie, you know, the ones where there's a depth charge attack and everybody's running around fixing leaks.
Hmm.
Well, that night, I mean, there was about a 20-hour time frame for the hurricane winds, and it's not the force on any given gust, but it's actually the constant pounding that has an impact on people. I was pretty much too busy fixing broken windows and at least trying to plug them so that we wouldn't get drenched inside the house, and running around trying to secure any kind of loose objects outside that could further break materials or actually endanger the structural integrity of the house. So it was a sleepless night, and mostly a sleepless day as well, as it made its path. The eye just went slightly south of us, but that put us close to the really fast gusts that happened close to the vicinity of the northern portion of the eye. And of course, what you hear thumping every so often, it was a tree hitting the house, etc. Mm. The house was safe. There was no structural damage other than window damage and the consequent leaking in of water. And it's funny, water driven by 140 mile an hour wind gust drenches you very fast, very rapid.
Yeah, and you are out in it. Fixing shingles and that kind of thing.
It felt like we were outside when we were inside. If a window broke, because the amount of wind and water that came in through that particular hole was immense. I mean, we dealt with about five broken windows that night. We were able to get them plugged up with whatever we could find, cloth or tissue or trash bags, etc. And then we were able to withstand the winds were not a problem from our perspective. I mean, they knocked down a few trees, and there were some trees strewn about the yard, etc. But fortunately, there was no impact damage of any significance anywhere.
And what did you see when it had finally passed and those difficult hours were over? You went out and you took a look around. What struck you?
Well, it looked like the place had been bombed, essentially. I mean, there were very few trees left standing. All the trees were bare, no leaves on them. Some of them, the bark had been stripped from the tree. So you weren't used to the nice browns of a tree trunk, but they looked very pale and yellowish as they were denuded by the wind speed. And, of course, a lot of branches, large ones, et cetera, littering everything around you. And, you know, an eerie quiet after the pounding for about 20 hours, which sort of gave it kind of a surreal feeling to the whole scenario.
We're talking with Dr. Julio Bird right now. He's a cardiologist at the Gunderson Health System Heart Institute in La Crosse. And he and his wife were in Puerto Rico when Maria hit, and they stayed for some time afterward. And Dr. Bird, the U.S. response to the catastrophe in Puerto Rico has become controversial, and there are differing attitudes coming from the White House and from some people in Puerto Rico. What is your assessment about how the United States has done rendering aid in the aftermath?
Well, by way of a general awareness, I mean any slow reaction or even regular reactions to damage and to lack of basic needs anywhere is accompanied by a great sense of anxiety regarding the speed at which things are handled. In the defense of those that are trying to do their very best, one has to say, well, Puerto Rico's an island, so you can't really have a convoy of trucks coming in to aid, as you might have in the continental U.S., where the situation's in Houston and Florida. One could put together an army of trucks, if you will, and make one's way to help the affected communities. The island poses some limitations to that effect, even though there was some planning early on. There was a hospital ship and some other ships sort of awaiting duties, and they were en route to Puerto Rico before the hurricane hit. Nevertheless, the problems, a lot of them have had to do with infrastructure. I mean, the loss of communications because of the loss of cell phone towers, et cetera, and then the loss of electrical power because most of the wiring of the island is above ground. So, and even concrete poles were snapped in half by the force of the wind, and then the lack of water, et cetera. As well as the flooding and the deaths related to flooding, added a lot of severity to what was going on. So, yes, there is some criticism as to the effectiveness of those measures. A lot of the ineffective consequences of the measures have to do with the fact that the if I could describe the infrastructure of support services in Puerto Rico, it's reduced to a thin veneer that is easily scratched. And the problem has a lot to do with the fact that with the financial issues that the island has faced, there have been cost containment measures that have had to be carried out by the government and others that meant a reduction in force of many of the organizations and agencies providing support, infrastructural support. So, for example, there had been 1,500 people laid off from the Department of for Electrical Services, for Power Services. And, of course, shortly after the hurricane had gone by and everything, there's ads for and recruitment posters for 1,800 necessary bodies. So the timing of this hurricane was almost designed to prove their shortcomings of a general and perhaps excessive response to the financial situation on the island. In addition to that, diesel fuel became an issue, and most hospitals were forced to go to diesel fuel to support their activities. And of course, that takes priority over anything else. But a lot of the other power generation in the island has a lot to do with diesel-powered electrical generators.
I want to ask you before we lose our time together. The president had made some remarks a week or so ago saying that, in a sense, Puerto Rico was spared. It didn't face the kind of catastrophe on the scale of a Hurricane Katrina.
Yeah.
And I wonder what your response to that is, and what you've been hearing from your family in Puerto Rico about that.
Well, let me put it in the context of my practice as a cardiologist. If I were to tell to somebody that has just had a heart attack, I say, well, I know yours was bad, but I've seen worse. That's not really, that's faint praise, I guess. and I think that those general off-the-cuff comments don't necessarily help recognize the fact that each society that experiences something of this nature is actually needing help at the time and not necessarily exculpatory or minimizing comments. So, I mean, that was a sad thing. I presume that sometimes people's statements do not reflect their true heartfelt intentions. But so be it. There's need to sort of be able to filter a little bit of the idle commentary. The other thing that offended some people, and maybe perhaps more than just some, was the fact that a comment was made that the island people were sitting around waiting for help rather than taking action themselves. And that is not what I witnessed. I witnessed the whole island develop a community attitude and actually initiate whatever measures they could take to protect those that had been hardest hit. And whenever they could be accessed, try to have one community help another. So I saw people rise to the occasion, and I think the comment did not help in terms of general feeling about the level of sympathy or perhaps empathy with the situation on the island.
Dr. Bird, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
That was Dr. Julio Bird. He's a cardiologist at the Gunderson Health System Heart Institute in La Crosse. He joined us today to talk about his firsthand experience surviving Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico. If you have a story, your own or maybe a friend or family member who was in Puerto Rico for Hurricane Maria is still there now. We would love to hear from you. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR or send us an email, ideas@WPR.org. You can also message us on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Dick Stockton has been a sportscaster for decades and decades. In general, he knows what he's doing.
But this weekend, he was calling the Rams-Jaguars game, and he had a bad moment.
On the Visa Halftime Report, Kurt Terry, Howie, Michael, and Tony look on graphic for the final two bullet points.
So he read the instruction out loud instead of doing what the instruction said.
And that clip went viral. A lot of people are making fun of him today, but not us.
No, not us at all, because this is one of the various broadcaster nightmares we have of accidentally reading a piece of script instruction live on the air instead of, you know, following it.
Just one of many broadcaster nightmares. Yeah. Right. There are many things that could go wrong, and in my case have gone wrong.
Oh, and me too. And I gotta say, since I started doing this job, I have gained just so much respect for live sportscasters, because they've got to keep talking and talking and talking. Even if the game gets boring or there's a long delay, they can't stop, and they always fill it. I'm pretty impressed.
And you know what? He really delivered it. He owned it. He delivered those bullet points.
He did not trail
off. I was convinced of his conviction all the way through.
Music fades in. File name. This is Central Time.